like frame this episode in like what how could we like talk about it, like, because it is obviously like a newsy episode, but it's also like a really old story that, like, you know, we've read so many times over and over again, which is like another coup in Latin America. This is like the oldest story in the book, or one of them, at least in the American geopolitical book. But maybe we could, everybody knows you, Ben. Maybe we'll start with introduction. This is Ben Norton. Everybody knows Ben Norton, friend of the show, longtime ally and comrade. Ben, you've been reporting on this very intensely. You've been talking about this. One of the few voices, actually, as it turns out. Maybe we could talk about that too, the relative silence, which this is all unfolded. But can you give us a rundown of what's been happening, and kind of for people who might have heard it or kind of just kind of glanced at the news, can you sort of fill us in last few weeks? There's been a lot that's happening, right?
Yeah, well, you mentioned, Sina, that this is not really a new story in terms of the dozens of coups that the United States has sponsored in Latin America. And this is yet another example of that. But it's also not a new story going back even further, hundreds of years, in that this is a very clear example of the continuation of this process of settler colonialism, where Peru, for the first time in modern history, has an indigenous descent president, similar to Evo Morales in Bolivia. And he's only allowed to govern for 17 months, and he's overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup and replaced with the European descent racist elites. So there are so many parallels going back to this process of European colonization, and we see that across Latin America, there still is an attempt to fully decolonize, because there were decolonial movements, anti-colonial movements that have achieved independence from Spanish colonialism, famously led by figures like Simón Bolívar and Francisco Morazán. But those anti-colonial struggles obviously still continue today against neocolonialism. And Peru, of all countries in the region, may be one of the best examples of that. This is a country like Bolivia that has a majority indigenous descent population, and yet they never really had an indigenous descent president until 2021. When the people of Peru elected Pedro Castillo. Who is Pedro Castillo? He is a teacher and a union organizer and a farmer from a very poor rural area in Peru. And he became prominent because he led a teacher strike. So he was not a politician. He had no political experience, but he became a national figure because he was the leader and the figurehead of a teacher strike. And that's why during his presidential campaign, people probably saw that his symbol was a pencil. He walked around with this like giant pencil, and that was a symbol of the fact that he was a teacher from a rural area. And in this rural area where he was a teacher, he was also a farmer, because most people there were subsistence farmers, or if it wasn't at least subsistence farming, they were just farming to have some extra income or some extra food. And in Peru, the political system has been dominated for hundreds of years by foreign elites, or I should say that many of them were born in Peru, but they're from families that were either colonizing families of European descent, or from, in the case of the dictatorship, of a Japanese family. Peru had a fascist dictator who governed the country from 1990 until 2000, named Alberto Fujimori, and his family still dominates a lot of Peruvian politics. And I'm not, you know, trying to engage in like a nativist. That's a bad word. I shouldn't use the term nativist. That's the term people use. But like, I'm not saying that like people who immigrate to Peru can't be Peruvian, but this is a discourse that you hear a lot from working class Peruvians, many of whom are of indigenous descent, who are critiquing the fact that their political class is very disproportionately dominated by people who are clearly of European descent or Japanese. In the case of not just the Fujimoris, in the case of a more recent president, his name was Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, which is clearly, he's of Polish descent. And there's so many examples of, you know, these leaders in Peru that have like Polish last names, German last names, Japanese last names. Clearly, there's a problem here where the political class does not represent the vast majority of Peruvians. It represents this small minority of comprador elites who are concentrated in Lima. And Lima is a relatively international city. It's a city with significant dominance of finance capital. And of course, we know that there's a direct parallel between the comprador, international bourgeoisie, and finance capital. They're much more interested in international capital than they are in developing the national industry in their country. And Peru is a good example of that. So you have, in Peru, you've had 7 presidents in 6 years, and 4 of those 7 presidents worked at the World Bank or New York-based banks. So you have basically a dictatorship run by the comprador bourgeoisie, people who have dual passports. I mentioned the president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. He literally had U.S. citizenship, and he worked in the United States for over 25 years. He was born in Peru, but he lived in the United States for over 25 years. He worked at the World Bank. He worked at New York investment banks, and he had U.S. citizenship until 2015. He gave up his U.S. citizenship in order to run for president in 2016. So that context is important to understand who Pedro Castillo is, because obviously there's a major class element. He's from a poor rural area, and he's going up against the wealthy capitalist elites in Lima. But there's very much a racial element as well, in that the indigenous descent majority of Peru have been completely left out of the mainstream bourgeois political system. So Pedro Castillo comes into power in 2021, and immediately, at first, the right-wing opposition refused to acknowledge his victory. And then immediately after he comes in, they launched a series of coup attempts. And in just over a year, the Peruvian Congress, which is dominated by the right-wing oligarchy, and it's notoriously corrupt. In September of 2021, the Peruvian Congress had a 7% approval rating, which is not really that much different from the US, but anyway, it had a 7% approval rating. And in the span of just over a year, the Peruvian Congress tried to launch 3 congressional coups against Pedro Castillo, the elected president. And it is true that there were a lot of people on the Peruvian left and part of the social movements that were very critical of Castillo because he wasn't able to do anything, because the left only had a small minority in the Congress. The right wing had a vast majority. And because at every single level, he never controlled the judiciary, which was waging judicial war against him, known as lawfare. He never controlled the military and the police who arrested him, as I'll talk about in a second. And he certainly didn't control the Congress. I mean, not only did he not have a majority, but the Congress was constantly launching this attempt that they call presidential vacancy. And this goes back to the Peruvian Constitution, which was written by the U.S.-backed Fujimori dictatorship in 1993. He dissolved Congress unconstitutionally and created a new constitution with basically no democratic insight. It was just, he claimed that the people supported it, but it was just fake. And he created this new neoliberal constitution. This is right at the beginning of, you know, this neoliberal unipolar era in the early 1990s. And he basically made it impossible for the Peruvian state to challenge neoliberal policy. It was baked into the very constitution. And then he launched this war of extermination against the left. And the left in Peru, socialist and revolutionary movements, tend to be largely associated with not just people who are poor and working class, but especially with indigenous descent Peruvians. So he also led a genocidal campaign. And Fujimori, actually, during the dictatorship in the 90s, he sterilized at least 300,000 indigenous descent Peruvians. And those are according to official government statistics. The actual figure could be higher. And by the way, the U.S. government funded that extermination program, the sterilization program, which is textbook genocide, through USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is a CIA cutout. They funded so-called family planning programs in Peru, which were just, you know, cover for sterilization of indigenous descent Peruvians. So anyway, that constitution is still the constitution that Peru has today. And one article of the constitution, which is Article 113, gives the Congress the authority to dissolve the presidency with what they call an act of presidential vacancy if the 2/3 of the unicameral Congress decide that the Peruvian president is morally incapable, has moral incapacity. Obviously, that doesn't really mean anything. What the actual constitutional article says is physical or moral incapacity. Obviously, physical incapacity would be, you know, like some kind of health problem. But moral incapacity means nothing. So that means that if the right-wing oligarchy, the, you know, comprador millionaire elites in Peru can bribe enough members of the Congress to vote for presidential vacancy, they can overthrow the democratically elected president. And there are videos that were leaked in this scandal that's called the Mamani Video scandal. And in that scandal, you could see the son of the former fascist dictator, Alberto Fujimori. His son was bribing other members of Congress. This was back in 2018, to vote for or against presidential vacancy. So it shows very clearly that the Peruvian Congress is an instrument of the, you know, capitalist class. They can just bribe people and they can overthrow any elected president they want if the president is going against their economic interests. And that's exactly what happened against Pedro Castillo 3 times. However, on the 3rd time, the day of the vote, which was December 7th, 2022, Pedro Castillo got word, knowing that they were going to try to launch this congressional coup against him, and they had whipped enough votes through bribery and corruption and all of that. So he went on TV and he gave a speech announcing the temporary closure of Congress. Now, that's an important word there. Temporary. He was not permanently going to close the Congress like Fujimori did. And what he did, unlike Fujimori, was constitutional according to Article 134 of the Constitution, which allows the president to dissolve Congress if the Congress has on 2 occasions taken political action against or denied the appointment of the Council of Ministers, which is the cabinet. And Congress has done that against Pedro Castillo. So he was in his constitutional right to temporarily dissolve the Congress. The Constitution said that he had to call for new elections within 4 months. And he said he was going to call for elections. But because he tried to temporarily dissolve Congress, the oligarchy, the Congress, used this as an opportunity to carry out the coup against him. And the military arrested him. And he was sentenced to 18 months in so-called preventative prison without a real trial, without due process. So this is a clear coup. It's a coup d'etat. Now, because he tried to dissolve Congress, and because even though he did it constitutionally, Fujimori, the U.S.-backed fascist dictator, also had dissolved Congress 20 years before, that led to this media narrative, and it was spread by the U.S. Embassy as well. And obviously, the U.S. Embassy was behind this coup, that supposedly Castillo was carrying out a self-coup, which is what Fujimori had did. But that's ridiculous, because what Castillo did was actually legal and constitutional, ironically, according to the very constitution created by Fujimori, that Castillo wanted to change. And one of his main campaign promises when he ran for president in 2021 is that he wanted to change the Fujimori dictatorship constitution and have a constituent assembly to create a constitution and to turn Peru into a plurinational state that recognizes the indigenous nations and their languages. That is based on the model that Bolivia implemented under Evo Morales. So that was one of his main promises. But of course, he was never able to implement that promise because of the constant obstructionism by the Congress, by the judicial attacks, by the corrupt judiciary, the lawfare attacks. So he was going to try to create a new constitution, but immediately after, the military arrested him. And then 3 hours after he made that decision, after he made that video, and by the way, in the video, he's alone. He's not surrounded by the military. And in fact, his hands are shaking. He's clearly terrified of what could potentially happen to him. He knew that he could potentially be killed or arrested. And in 3 hours after that announcement, the Congress, the right-wing corrupt Congress with 7% approval, they appoint his vice president, who was completely corrupt and an opportunist, and she had been expelled from the Socialist Party that he had been part of, which is the Peru Libre Party. She had been expelled from that party in January, and she said that she didn't even believe in the ideology. So she's a corrupt opportunist, and she was appointed president by the corrupt Congress. And immediately on the floor of Congress, she announced that she's going to create a government of national unity and a truce with the right-wing opposition. So that what that means is that the right-wing opposition who lost the elections in the Congress were going to be given half of the seats in the cabinet as a political truce. So this is a coup in which the right wing that lost the elections was given control of the government, including most of the most important ministries. And of course, she's a puppet. Her name is Dina Boluarte. She's a complete puppet. She doesn't control anything. What really has happened is that the U.S. Embassy clearly backed this coup, and I can talk more about how we have evidence that the U.S. Embassy was directly behind this coup. And the U.S. ambassador in Peru, Lisa Kenna, is a so-called former CIA agent. And we, as we all know, there's no such thing as a former CIA agent. She was a CIA agent for 9 years, according to her State Department bio. And she was appointed the ambassador to Peru. And one day before the coup, the CIA agent turned U.S. ambassador, Lisa Kenna, she met with the Peruvian defense minister, who's the one who on the day of the coup gave the order to the military not to allow Pedro Castillo to temporarily dissolve Congress to go against Pedro Castillo. So the U.S. Embassy was clearly behind this. The U.S. State Department was clearly behind this. They immediately recognized Dina Boluarte as the president, and immediately the coup regime cracks down with brutal violence, leading to a massacre because there were huge protests, especially in rural and poor areas, especially among indigenous descent Peruvians. And there were huge protests with three main demands. The first demand was closing the Congress. So Pedro Castillo's attempt to close Congress was very popular among poor and working Peruvians, working class Peruvians. They supported that decision to close the Congress, while the right-wing millionaire oligarch-controlled media in Peru and the U.S. Embassy, they were the ones accusing Castillo of trying to launch a coup, which is insane. It's like blaming the victim of a coup of supposedly trying to carry out a coup. So if you listen to what people in the streets are saying, and I've interviewed people in Peru, and I've done a lot of translations of videos of the protests. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to go to Peru because, one, it's very difficult to fly to Peru because the airports were closed because of the protests, but also it's just insanely expensive to even fly in the first place. But anyway, the point is, if you listen to what the protesters are saying in Peru, they're saying that they support the attempt to close the Congress. They want to close the Congress. Their other demand is new elections as soon as possible. And their other demand is releasing Pedro Castillo, because I mentioned he's been arrested and imprisoned for 18 months without trial. And finally, their most important demand is a constituent assembly to create a new constitution and a plurinational state, which is what Castillo had tried to do but was never able to accomplish. And now, finally, that brings us to the violence. So after the coup, there are these massive protests, especially in rural areas, and the coup regime responded by deploying not only the police, but also the military, and they massacred at least 28 protesters in a bloodbath with potentially hundreds wounded. I mean, just horrifying videos showing that these very heavily militarized police and soldiers, and even the Peruvian government has what is officially an autonomous human rights watchdog, which is not really that autonomous, but even they had to acknowledge that the Peruvian coup regime, completely backed by the U.S. government, the Peruvian coup regime sent soldiers out with live ammunition and with helicopters, and these soldiers were shooting protesters from helicopters and dropping tear gas bombs on them from helicopters. So that led to a massacre of at least 28 protesters. And in the meantime, the U.S. State Department was totally supporting the coup regime. The U.S. The CIA agent turned U.S. Ambassador Lisa Kenna met with the fake president, Dina Boluarte, and took a photo with her, praising her and saying that she represents the democratic will of the Peruvian people, despite not being elected. And Antony Blinken had a phone call with her saying that she represents the democratic will of the Peruvian people. The State Department spokesman, Ned Price, who's also a so-called former CIA agent, so a CIA agent turned State Department spokesman, he gave us he gave comments praising Dina Boluarte and her coup regime as she was massacring protesters and said she represents the democratic will of the Peruvian people. And the, of course, the Organization of American States, the OAS, which is basically an instrument of U.S. geopolitical power in the region, they also gave their approval, the rubber stamp, to support the coup regime in Peru. However, there is something very interesting happening. 14 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean have refused to recognize the coup regime and still support Pedro Castillo as the constitutional president. They have made comments condemning the coup and calling for Castillo to be released from prison, including some of the most populated countries in the region, such as Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, also Bolivia, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Honduras, and multiple Caribbean nations, including St. Vincent and the Grenadines, St. Lucia, Grenada. So what we're seeing is a massive rebellion, not only by the people of Peru, but also a rebellion by Latin America and the Caribbean. 14 countries have rebelled against this U.S.-backed coup. So it shows that the situation is different now. It's very different from even 2019, when there were still a lot of right-wing governments that controlled most of, not most, but several governments in the region. And when Evo Morales was overthrown in a coup, he did get support from Mexico and Argentina. But now Colombia has been a new addition, and Lula da Silva comes into power in Brazil on January 1st. So the region is shifting back to the left, and it's very different from the coups back, you know, for instance, in 2012 against Fernando Lugo, or 2016 against Dilma Rousseff. There are parallels with that, but we see that Latin America is publicly condemning this coup and challenging the U.S. So that's a very, you know, it's not brief, I guess, but that's a nutshell overview of everything in Peru to understand what's happening.
Thank you, Ben. That was really helpful. I knew that you would be able to give us like both the global and the sort of local perspective, in the sense, like temporally speaking, because yeah, like this is an old story, and this is like a global story too, where, you know, we're talking at, you know, moments like this are like really instructive. I feel that like you learn a lot about the internal workings of a country, but you also learn about the machinery that the imperialists, most like and above them all the U.S., can put into place to pursue those efforts. So like the U.S. has all these, like, it's like a Swiss Army knife. It has all these like tools at its you know, at its use, at its like fingertips, that it could like deploy, right? Some are media based, some are economic, some are military if it comes to that, and some are diplomatic, obviously. Like there's a whole host of them, and it's moments like this that you can see what works, like when, and like the different, like, and even response, and like the kinds of response that those tools like utilize, right? Like sometimes silence, say on the part of the media, right, is an aid of a coup. But on the other times, it also really helps a coup. So I think of 2011 and the Arab Spring and the like insane amount of attention and like media press. And like just recently in Iran, right? Like here are these intense protests, right? And yet that is like something that is deemed newsworthy. Now here's something that's also happening in Peru. And yet, quel surprise, it's not, you know, like, and not every liberal is like going insane, jumping off a bridge or cutting their hair in solidarity, right? Like those performative, like that, I always say this like on my show that like the media, like the sort of Western media's like unique tool is like the ability to, it's kind of to pursue this kind of breathless media coverage that like it can just like flip a switch and everyone is losing their minds like all of a sudden. And that triggers people, I feel, that like people still have this ingrained idea that the news reflects the world. So like the more news around a topic, the more inherently newsworthy it is. And yet in the case of Peru, like not a peep, right? Like not a peep. It's been totally like just whatever. It's been totally like pushed off, right? And like this is like a good moment to see instructive of like how this machinery works. Like it's not Maidan, right, of 2014. It's not like the loudness here. There was a, I feel at least from my vantage point of like an outsider. Now, mind you, like I follow a lot of like independent news media, people like obviously you, Multipolarista, but also Kalsechian News, like a ton of other sources. And they've been the ones who have been pushing this story, obviously, because, you know, the people who are protesting, like those people are deemed newsworthy by people like you and people like Kalsechian News. But of course, like we're in the minority here. So of course, that's that kind of whirlwind of solidarity doesn't exist. So for our minds over here in the West, like if a tree falls, it's the tree falls in the forest. Like if something happens revolutionary and you don't hear about it, or in this case, counter-revolutionary, you don't hear about it, like it doesn't occur. So I feel like this is a good example to see all those different things. Now, maybe if I can narrow that down, what institutions would you say prove, like, okay, actually, I mean, let me phrase it this way. This, for something like this to happen also, like shows that the coalition that was in place that was just overthrown clearly like didn't have these political institutions under its foot, like whatever the things that got away from this government, right? Like that's how it works. And so in moments like this, you see the like constituent axes of a country. In Peru, like what are they? Like where are they? I mean, obviously it's class-based, but and in some ways, you know, ethnically based in a sense, right? In the sense that like settler, with relationship to the historic settler colonialism, as you explained. But like, what would you say is like the most instructive thing about how Peru works or doesn't work from this story?
Yeah, well, the point is that there are no popular institutions because any remnants of popular institutions were destroyed under the Fujimori dictatorship. I mean, again, I just want to stress that Fujimori, who was like a textbook dictator, like he dissolved Congress unconstitutionally. He governed as a dictator. He dissolved democratic institutions. He was in power until 2000 with U.S. support again, and he committed genocide. And in addition to the racial genocide targeting indigenous peoples, he carried out an extermination war against the left. And in Latin America, of course, historically, indigenous movements tend to be associated with the left because they're almost always left wing. It's a very similar story with the genocide in Guatemala in the 1980s, which was also backed by the U.S. and by Israel. There was a fascist dictator in Guatemala who was also an evangelical Christian, Efraín Ríos Montt, and he considered the Maya population to all be communists because there was a communist guerrilla movement, and there were a lot of indigenous people involved in that guerrilla movement against the U.S.-backed right-wing military dictatorship. And this is, of course, during the CIA-Contra wars in Central America. So he committed genocide. He considered all the indigenous Maya people to be communists, and he just massacred them and had a scorched earth campaign. And we see a very similar situation 20 years later. Well, not even 20 years, 10, 15 years later in Peru under Fujimori. And part of this is because there was a very strange Maoist group in Peru, Shining Path, Sendero Luminoso was their name. And they were very sectarian and they were not led by indigenous people. In fact, they did abuse a lot of indigenous people. They were led by Guzman, people probably know. Chairman Guzman, he's famously known as Gonzalo, Chairman Gonzalo Guzman. And he was definitely not indigenous. In fact, he was a petty bourgeois professor, and he like taught philosophy, and he was like in Lima most of the time. But he ran this very sectarian Maoist group that killed a lot of leftists and killed a lot of indigenous people. But because the far-right dictatorship was so brutal and it imposed neoliberal austerity and the life was so difficult for people in rural areas, that there was support for, in general, armed resistance movements. There were other armed groups that had much better politics than Shining Path. Shining Path also took this position of like, you know, the Soviet Union is social imperialist and they were against Cuba and whatever. The point is that there were a series of different armed groups. Sendero Luminoso is one of the most famous, but there were other armed groups as well. And because there were revolutionary armed socialist movements, it gave the fascist coup regime of Fujimori an excuse to carry out extreme violence and accuse anyone who was against him of being a terrorist. So if you had to compare a country in the region that would be similar, it would be Colombia. Colombia, of course, has never had a left-wing government until recently, until this August, when their first ever left-wing president, Gustavo Petro, took power. And he himself was a former guerrilla in an armed socialist movement called the M19 movement. And of course, Colombia has been, you know, devastated by this kind of internal civil war going back decades. And Peru had a similar story. But the way that Peru dealt with it is a fascist dictator who exterminated the left and killed thousands of people and tortured people and disappeared people and exiled many people. So even if someone on the left in Peru was not involved in an armed movement, if they were against the coup regime of Fujimori, and if they opposed his neoliberal economic policies backed by the US and the Washington Consensus and the IMF and the World Bank, they were often accused of being terrorists, and you could be disappeared and imprisoned and killed. So, I mean, the left was exterminated quite literally in Peru. And by 2000, when Fujimori left, he also was extremely corrupt, surprise, surprise. And he actually fled to Japan at first because he was also a Japanese national. And in Japan, the Japanese government refused to extradite him, and he was an idiot. And Fujimori was such like an arrogant megalomaniac that he actually went back to Peru to try to run for president again, thinking that they weren't going to arrest him for corruption. And they arrested him, and he was imprisoned for blatant corruption and also just, you know, murder. And there were, so during the Fujimori dictatorship, the head of his very feared secret police is this guy named Vladimir Montessori. And he was filmed, he filmed everything. He was one of these guys who was like Richard Nixon, who recorded and filmed everything secretly. And he was filmed bribing people, ordering assassinations of political opposition. I mean, a fascist dictatorship. And he was imprisoned as well. And the coup regime now, the U.S.-backed coup regime today in Peru, has brought back many of those figures who were involved in the secret police in the Fujimori dictatorship, including they recently just appointed this guy as the head of the intelligence services in Peru, who, and one of his last names, by the way, is O'Connor. So once again, I mean, like, the elites in Peru, like, their names are Kuczynski and O'Connor and Fujimori. Like, they're clearly not, like, of indigenous descent, yet alone, like, you know, of Peruvian descent. Anyway, the point is that those elements of the Fujimori dictatorship are still very much involved in the Peruvian deep state. And they have significant influence in the military, in the police, in the intelligence services. And they were brought back today, like in the past few weeks, this December, by the Peruvian coup regime. So the point is that Peru is basically a failed state. That's why they've had 7 presidents in 6 years. That's why the Congress is just, it's controlled by a bunch of right-wing politicians who are bought by the oligarchy. There are basically no democratic institutions in Peru. They were all destroyed. And of course, ever since the end of the Fujimori dictatorship in 2000, you just had a series of neoliberal governments. Pedro Castillo was basically the only left-wing government, left-wing president, like in Colombia. Colombia and Peru have a lot in common historically. And in Colombia, you can bet that Gustavo Petro is watching very closely. And Gustavo Petro has made a lot of comments about this. Gustavo Petro, the new left-wing Colombian president, visited Peru to meet with Pedro Castillo a few weeks before the coup. And he tweeted that when he went to go visit Castillo, a parliamentary coup was already in motion against him. And he said that he got to the Peruvian presidential palace and Pedro Castillo was terrified. He was already scared because he knew that they were trying to do a coup against him. And they were investigating his wife and his daughter for like on fake corruption charges, which also shows how in Peru, the judiciary is completely corrupt. It's controlled by Fujimori elements. It's not elected. And the judiciary in Latin America, this is a major problem. It's also increasingly a problem in the United States, where we see these just like far right Christian fanatics take control over the judiciary, and they're not elected. And they, in the case of the Supreme Court, they're appointed for life. Well, that same strategy has already been implemented for decades in Latin America. And we see the same thing happen, for instance, in Argentina on December 6th, one day before the U.S.-backed coup against Pedro Castillo in Peru. There was a judicial coup against the left-wing former president and current vice president, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, in which the corrupt right-wing judiciary, who were filmed and they were taking photos of the prosecutors taken, meeting with members of the big corporations that fund the opposition, like the Grupo Clarín, and flying on their planes and going to their mansions for dinner and stuff. Like, the point is that they carried out a judicial coup against Cristina Fernández de Kirchner one day before. And the judiciary in Peru was constantly investigating Castillo's ministers on fake charges of corruption or even terrorism. They were investigating his wife and his daughter. So, I mean, Peru is a complete failed state. You can't govern in Peru. There is no democracy in Peru. So the State Department talks about supporting democracy and all this and backing the coup regime as the voice of the democratic will. It's complete BS. Democracy, even bourgeois democracy, for all of its very deep limitations, it doesn't exist in Peru. Peru is a neo-colonial oligarchy controlled by a bunch of comprador elites, many of which who have dual passports, and they impose neoliberal austerity and exploit the indigenous descent working class majority and treat them basically the same way that the Spanish colonialists had treated Peru. In Colombia, we see that Gustavo Petro is trying to democratize the state and bring in Afro-Colombian communities and indigenous Colombians and create universal health care and education and pensions. But I mean, even he doesn't have a lot of control. He doesn't have a majority in the Congress. And you can bet that a lot of the elements of the military and the police in Colombia are also very much linked to these kinds of deep state elements. So that's, I mean, the U.S. talks about democracy in these countries, but they're neo-colonial regimes and they can't have real democracy because they're basically controlled by the comprador class, which acts as puppets for Washington.
Yeah, I mean, this is I feel like we have to kind of take this example and like the countless other examples. I mean, think about what happened in Bolivia, right? There was this coup, like Evo almost died, like he was almost murdered, and he escaped to Mexico at the last minute. Right? Was that what happened? Yeah, he escaped and like he slept in someone's backyard under guard or something, in like a hammock or something.
Yeah, so really briefly, in November, he was overthrown. And I mean, there are parallels to the coup in Bolivia I can talk about. But the point is, he was overthrown. And then the Mexican Air Force sent a plane to take him out because he had applied for asylum. And the Bolivian army, bribed by the U.S. and full of these, you know, traitors, they tried to shoot down a Mexican Air Force aircraft, which would have been an act of war against Mexico, in addition to killing their elected president, Evo Morales.
That's so fucked. I didn't know that. I had no idea that happened. I know that he escaped, and I know that they murdered his dog. They, like, ran over his dog with, like, a tank or something, and, like, they were trying to kill him, but I didn't realize that they also tried to shoot down his plane, which is actually... And this is what happened to... who's the guy? Was it Yushchenko who was kicked out of Ukraine? He made it out of his life too. He had to be guided out essentially by Russian military, and who came and basically rescued him at the last moment. But he was driving, not Yushchenko. I can't remember. It was the two victors. Is it Yanukovych and Yushchenko? Is that right?
Yanukovych.
Yanukovych. Right. It was the two victors. I think that was that.
Yushchenko
era.
Was like the pro EU neoliberal, but. I mean, not that Yanukovych anti-neoliberal, but one quick point on this subject of Evo Morales and people and foreign countries attacking, or I guess in this case, the Bolivian military. But anyway, the attacks on his planes. Let's not forget that also, if you remember, when Edward Snowden did the NSA leaks, he he applied for asylum in Ecuador, which had also given asylum to Julian Assange. And the U.S. government grounded illegally Evo Morales's presidential aircraft when he was back when he was president of Bolivia. They grounded his aircraft, which is a blatant crime, international crime. It violates all international law. They treated Evo Morales like as if he's just like not a president, as if he's just some guy in a plane trying to look for Edward Snowden.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it's. I mean, that's the thing. Like, when you're there's. It's like this is. We need to always remember like one thing. We live in this like colonial era, right? Like, it's not post-colonial. It's just neo-colonial, and that neo-colonial era is led by one actor, one single hegemon, whose decisions are like the final. Like, the buck stops there, so to speak. And that hegemon, when you anger them enough, like that hegemon will like react in these like insane, like crazy violent ways. And there is no law. Like, there is no international law. Like, did the US respect international law when they fucking invaded Iraq and like destroyed the country and like occupied it and installed a viceroy? No, that's neocolonialism. So like, one of the things that's like a lesson, I hate to say it, for Castillo is like, get your ducks in a row before you try like radical changes, because democracy doesn't work. Democracy is for like, democracy is a word that we have to summarize these like liberal institutions that are supposedly guaranteed and built on this foundation of voting and popular vote, but we all know that nobody cares to vote. A minority of the population in most countries vote and don't. I mean, of course, the difference vary by country, but in the end, like, that connection between vote and politician and representative is very tenuous in, I would say, most countries, right? That the elites represent a class of people, and if they're sometimes they're voted in, sometimes they're just born in, sometimes they buy their way in through their connections to sort of multinational concerns or whatever. But in the end, we're talking about a class of people who rule, and they rule violently. So like, have we like, I don't know, I feel like, I guess the story of Evo and Mas prove me wrong, that like, you can win like the old fashioned way, like, so to speak, like by playing by the rules. But like, so like, that I guess is a heartening response and like sort of proves me that I'm not necessarily right. But I don't know. I feel like, you know, this is a moment where you realize like what a state is. And a state is like a violence apparatus, and it's a bureaucracy, and it's a financial and social elite. And if you're like not on their side, and if they're like not one of them, like, you will make enemies among them right away, and they will like move their pieces around to get you out of power. I mean, this is the story of Iran too, 53, right? Like, 53, he was like, Mossadegh wasn't strong enough to take out those reforms that he was trying. He wasn't strong enough to like back that sovereign, that claim to sovereignty, which he was trying, right? Like, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is that you're either a sovereign country, which means you go to war with the hegemon, or you're the US, who then decides when your sovereignty begins and when your sovereignty ends, as we've just seen in Europe, right? Like, Europe, they destroyed the continent, they destroyed like the industry, they destroyed like the political systems. They don't care. That's like what the US does to its allies. Like, imagine what it does to like its enemies. So like, I don't know. I feel like you need the violence mechanism of the Peruvian state, whatever it is. He can't buy that force. Like, whoever's on his side can't buy that. So then they need popular will. I mean, and this is like an old story, right? Like, this is political struggle in most countries. How it works is, you know, like, how do you overturn the ruling power? And the ruling power do it themselves to each other sometimes, right? If they don't like each other. So like, this unfortunately is one of those stories. I don't know. Maybe we should think about wrapping it up. I know you're busy. What do you think are like, what's the best way to kind of keep, I mean, obviously we have to keep talking about this and following sources, but how would you see, like, what can be the next steps here, both politically and in terms of, you know, international solidarity, which I don't think exists, but let's just pretend it does.
Yeah, well, I have a few thoughts. I mean, I want to respond briefly to what you were saying about, you know, bourgeois liberal democracy. I mean, I agree. Vladimir Lenin famously said that democracy today under capitalism remains what it was under the ancient Greeks, democracy only for the slave owners. Just replace the slave owners with the capital owners, and it's basically the same. I mean, I don't think bourgeois liberal democracy is the end of history. I don't think it's a good political system at all. It's certainly not democratic. In the context of Latin America, it's a little different. And in the context in general in the global South, I think it's different. Being in Latin America for several years and being more immersed in that and talking with a lot of people, it made me understand a little bit, even among some revolutionaries, why, although they certainly aren't a big fan of bourgeois liberal democracy, they think that it's necessary in this historical stage. Even Fidel Castro had made that argument because of the history of the right-wing dictatorships that ruled Latin America until very recently, and Operation Condor, right? Known also as Plan Condor. And a lot of people in Latin America now have been talking about Operation Condor 2.0 with the coup in Bolivia, the coup in Peru, the two coups in Brazil in 2016 and 2018. And I mean, let's not forget, I mentioned that Fujimori was, he was an old school style fascist dictator in Peru until 2000. But also Argentina had a fascist military dictatorship until 1983. Brazil had a fascist military dictatorship until 1985. So there are a lot of people who still remember that. I mean, Pinochet in Chile, like the U.S. installed a bunch of fascist military dictatorships who didn't even have the pretense of bourgeois liberal democracy, where quite literally you could be murdered or imprisoned or disappeared by the state with no consequences just for being a leftist or a labor organizer. So I'm certainly not a fan of liberal democracy, but I understand why a lot of revolutionaries even and leftists in Latin America still prefer liberal bourgeois democracy to that because they remember those horrible years. But yeah, I mean, we see very clearly, you know, Cuba understands that bourgeois liberal democracy is not the be-all end-all. Cuba is more democratic than the U.S., certainly. And Cuba does have elections, but it doesn't have, you know, fake bourgeois elections in which millionaires can just buy candidates like in other countries. So, I mean, I agree with that, but I just wanted to explain that context for why in Latin America, a lot of the left and, you know, like the MAS movement towards socialism in Bolivia, why they have been focused on still maintaining bourgeois liberal democracy, because Bolivia also had a fascist military dictatorship until just four decades ago. And Evo Morales remembers that those years, right? Now, in terms of comments you made about, you know, international solidarity and stuff, I mean, I think there's a lot of things to say in response to that. First of all, I think people need to understand how the character of coups has shifted. And this goes in hand with like this concept of, you know, intersectional imperialism, right? I just saw that the CIA cut out the National Endowment for Democracy, the NED, is funding a lot of media outlets in Ukraine, a lot of propaganda. But what is so insidious is that it's now funding media outlets in Ukraine that are defending what they call indigenous rights of Ukrainians, which is insane. And they're saying that Russia is guilty of colonialism. So quite literally, the CIA is funding anti-colonial and pro-indigenous propaganda in scare quotes, which obviously it's actually neocolonialism in the guise of anti-colonialism. So while the U.S. is supporting a coup regime in Peru that is massacring indigenous descent Peruvians, after backing a fascist coup in Bolivia against an indigenous president, the U.S. is funding, the CIA is funding so-called pro-indigenous media in Ukraine. It's insane, but it shows how cynical imperialism is and how imperialism will weaponize anything that it can try to, you know, empty of meaning to turn into a rhetorical discursive weapon. And I think when we look at the character of coups, that reflects that kind of intersectional imperialist strategy, where the coups of the 21st century, especially in the past 10 years, have been more sophisticated. The last direct military-style coup we have seen in Latin America was 2009 against the elected left-wing president, Manuel Zelaya, who was trying to do a constitutional referendum, a constituent assembly, just like Pedro Castillo, and the military overthrew in 2009. There was no pretense of democracy or any of that. But if you look at the coups since then, and that coup in Honduras was actually planned by the Obama administration. Sorry, it was planned by the Bush administration, specifically John Negroponte, who was a veteran of the Contra Wars in the 80s, a CIA asset. And then when Obama came in under the Hillary Clinton State Department, she continued those plans. She carried out the Bush admin's coup. But if you look at the other coups that were carried out by the Democrats under Obama, they were more sophisticated coups. So in 2012, there was a very similar congressional coup against the leftist president Fernando Lugo in Paraguay. And then in 2016, there was the congressional coup against Dilma Rousseff of the Workers' Party in Brazil. And those were both Obama's coups. There was a coup attempt in 2010 against Rafael Correa, the socialist president of Ecuador. There was another failed coup attempt in 2009 against Evo Morales, but that was failed. And then you fast forward to the Trump administration. Then there was the second part of the coup against Lula da Silva in Brazil in 2018. And that was a judicial coup using the judicial system by CIA asset, the judge Sergio Moro, who accused Lula falsely of corruption and imprisoned him on fake charges. The Brazilian Supreme Court later absolved him of all those charges. And the UN Human Rights Committee said that Lula had his political and civil rights violated. So that was another example of these unconventional coups that you can call lawfare, right? Or a congressional coup against Dilma Rousseff, which is very similar to the congressional coup against Pedro Castillo this December. And then you have the coup attempt, the violent coup attempt in Venezuela in 2017, which failed. Then you have the violent coup attempt in Nicaragua in 2018, which failed. And then you have the successful coup against Evo Morales in 2019, which succeeded, but it was a more sophisticated coup because even though there was violence involved and the U.S. we have proof that the U.S. bribed the Bolivian military to turn against Evo Morales, also there was a more sophisticated narrative. If you remember, the Organization of American States accused Evo Morales of stealing the election, which was completely absurd. And because Evo Morales was trying to run for a fourth term as a president, there was this narrative, which was absurd, that he was supposedly a dictator. So the point is that, and now you fast forward to the coup in Bolivia, where the narrative is supposedly that Pedro Castillo was carrying out a coup, and the coup had to be carried out against him to save Peruvian democracy. It's very similar to the strategy used in Pakistan. This is not just in Latin America. The U.S. backed a congressional coup, a parliamentary coup in Pakistan in April 2022, in which the U.S. ambassador was whipping votes in the parliament, allegedly bribing people to vote for a parliamentary coup against the democratically elected prime minister Imran Khan over his independent foreign policy and his alliance with China and Russia, his opposition to sanctions on Iran, calling for the U.S. to lift sanctions on Iran, supporting Palestine, refusing to normalize relations with Israel. And immediately after the parliamentary coup against Imran Khan, a corrupt right-wing neoliberal coup regime came into power in Pakistan, and it has refused to have new elections, just like the U.S.-backed coup regime in Peru. So the reason I named all those examples is it shows that the character of these coups has shifted. It's no longer the old school style, 1973 fascist Pinochet coup. It's now a more sophisticated coup where they use lawfare, judicial warfare. They use congressional coups through the parliament. They use fake corruption charges. This is the new era of coups that we're in. And it's more difficult to oppose these kinds of coups because it's hybrid warfare. These are the new tactics of hybrid warfare. So people need to understand how these mechanisms work. People need to understand what lawfare is. They need to understand that when leaders are accused of corruption or this BS, that it's bogus. There's no evidence of this. It's part of the propaganda war and the hybrid war. And they need to stop caring about what these dumb liberals who write for The Guardian care. If you support people like Evo Morales or Pedro Castillo or Daniel Ortega or Nicolas Maduro, they are the democratically elected constitutional presidents of these countries. They have the support of the people of their countries. And stop giving into these liberal imperialists who claim that if you support them, that you're an authoritarian or you support corruption or petro-populism or whatever. Like those Naomi Kleins of the world who are so concerned about liberal respectability, they represent the new supposed left-wing gatekeepers for imperialism. They're the useful idiots funded by big billionaire foundations like Rockefeller and Open Society and Ford. They're the ones who are manufacturing consent for this new generation of coups, just like the old school people in the 70s and 80s who openly defended the Pinochet coups. That's my final word on this.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. This was Blainer. Keep an eye on things and looking forward to more reporting.
Yeah, thanks, Sina. Keep up the awesome work. I always love your...